This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Feeling uncomfortable? Extreme heat is bubbling up all over the world. Searing temperatures are back in India. They never left China and Southeast Asia. Now it's Mexico setting up cooling centers and sweating it out. France and Spain are cooking. Maps showing high ocean temperatures literally around the world are really scary. Fortunately, there is a solution. Just pretend it isn't happening. There, fixed it. But what if you suffer from I still see reality syndrome? Oh, that's too bad. You feel like the only one awake in the slumber room of mass media and social fantasy? That is why, as global climate negotiators backpedal into loving methane and carrying on drilling, that is why it is refreshing to hear at least one voice of authority calling them out. Following yet another failed climate negotiating session in Bonn, Germany, UN Chief Antonio Guterres met with major climate campaigners instead. On June 15, he came out swinging in a press conference in New York City. You need to hear this. It's just 10 minutes of truth you will not hear on TV.
We are months away from the SDG, the Climate Ambition Summits, with COP28 following soon after. And I am very worried where the world stands on climate. Countries are far off track in meeting climate promises and commitments. I see a lack of ambition, a lack of trust, a lack of support, a lack of cooperation, and an abundance of problems around clarity and credibility. The climate agenda is being undermined. At a time when we should be accelerating action, there is backtracking. At a time when we should be filling gaps, these gaps are growing. And meanwhile, the human rights of climate activists are being trampled. The most vulnerable are suffering the most. Current policies are taking the world to a 2.8 degree temperature rise by the end of the century. That spells catastrophe, yet the collective response remains pitiful. We are hurtling towards disaster, eyes wide open, with far too many willing it all on wishful thinking and proven technologies and silver bullet solutions. It's time to wake up and step up. It's time to rebuild trust based on climate justice. It's time to accelerate the just transition to a green economy. Limiting the rise in global temperature to 1.5 degrees Celsius is still possible. We must consider this as a moment of hope. But it will require carbon emissions to be cut by 45% by 2030. To help get us there, I have proposed the Climate Solidarity Pact, in which all big emitters would make extra efforts to cut emissions, and wealthier countries supporting emerging economies to do so. And I have put forward an acceleration agenda to supercharge these efforts. I urge governments to make it happen by hitting fast forward on their net zero deadlines so that developed countries can meet to reach net zero as close as possible to 2040 and emerging economies as close as possible to 2050. And developed countries must abide by their commitments on finance, adaptation, and loss and damage. And they must also push multilateral development banks to adapt their business models, skill sets, and approaches to risk in order to leverage far more private finance at reasonable cost to developing countries to allow for a massive increase in investment in renewables. That investment is the only way to achieve global energy security independent of the present unpredictable market fluctuations. And in every country, without exception, civil society voices must be heard. They must be at the table helping to shape policy and on the ground helping to deliver change. All of this action must be global, it must be immediate, and it must start with the polluted heart of the climate crisis, the fossil fuel industry. Let's face facts. The problem is not simply fossil fuel emissions. It's fossil fuels, period. The solution is clear. The world must phase out fossil fuels in a just and equitable way, moving to leave oil, coal and gas in the ground where they belong, and massively boosting renewable investment in a just transition. Fossil fuel industry transition plans must be transformation plans that chart a company's move to clean energy and away from a product incompatible with human survival. Otherwise, they are just proposals to become more efficient planet wreckers. Of course, we must recognize that transformations don't happen overnight. Transition plans are precisely to provide a roadmap for a managed, orderly process that guarantees affordability, access, and energy security. How do we get there? Our acceleration agenda calls on governments to commit to no new coal, complete phasing out coal by 2030 in OECD countries and 2040 elsewhere, and all international coal funding, both public and private, and end licensing or funding of new oil and gas, stopping the expansion of existing oil and gas reserves, and supporting the just transition of the impacted developing countries. Ensure net zero electricity generation by 2035 in developed countries and 2040 everywhere else. And shift subsidies from fossil fuels to renewables and to a just energy transition. Put a price on carbon and establish a progressive global phase out of existing oil and gas production compatible with global net zero emissions by 2050. But the fossil fuel industry and its enablers have a special responsibility. Last year, the oil and gas industry reaped a record $4 trillion US dollars windfall in net income. Yet for every dollar it spends on oil and gas drilling and exploration, only 4 cents went to clean energy and carbon capture combined. Trading the future for 30 pieces of silver is immoral. The world needs the industry to apply its massive resources to drive, not obstruct, the global move from fossil fuels to renewables and reap the benefits if they themselves lead the transition. Yet, right now, the industry is not even reaching the very low operational emissions reductions targets it has set for itself. Many are running late, and most rely on dubious offsets. I call on all fossil fuel companies to present credible, comprehensive, and detailed new transition plans, fully in line with all the recommendations of my high-level expert group on net zero pledges. These plans must cover all activities up and down the value chain. That must include reducing emissions from production, processing, transmission, refining, distribution, and use. And they must establish clear near-term targets that chart the business transition to clean energy. Fossil fuel companies must also cease and desist influence peddling and legal threats designed to kneecap progress. I'm thinking particularly of recent attempts to subvert net zero alliances invoking antitrust legislations. Governments are pivotal in setting the record straight. They must help by providing clear reassurance. Collective climate action does not violate antitrust. It upholds the public trust. At the same time, financial institutions must encourage this transformation of the fossil fuel industry. I urge all financial institutions to present public, credible, and detailed plans to transition their funding from fossil fuels to clean energy. Again, we know that this transition will not occur overnight. These plans should contain clear targets for 2025 and 2030. And they should include an explicit strategy to progressively strip out fossil fuel assets from their portfolios to ensure they become credibly net zero aligned. They must show how capital expenditure, research and development, and investments are aligned with net zero targets. And they must disclose all lobbying and policy engagement activities. Financial institutions everywhere must end lending, underwriting, and investments in coal anywhere, including new coal infrastructure, power plants, and mines. And they must commit to end financing and investment for exploration for new oil and gas fields and expansion of oil and gas reserves, investing instead in the just transition in the developing world. To those finance institutions already shifting from fossil fuels to renewables, I have a special message of hope and encouragement. Do not relent in the face of attacks on progress. You are doing the right thing. Keep going. As my discussion with civil society leaders today made clear, there is simply too much at stake for us to be silent. There is too much at risk for us to sit on the sidelines. Now must be the time for ambition and action, and I look forward to welcoming first movers and doers at my climate ambition summit in September. The world is watching, and the planet can't wait.
That was Antonio Guterres speaking at the United Nations on June 15th, 2023. So in case you have not heard, the only world effort to save our climate has gone off the rail. I'm talking about the COP system. The conference in Bonn that's planning it agreed two things would not be on the agenda for COP28 in Abu Dhabi: a phase-out of fossil fuels and financing a just transition for developing countries. The two things we need to do most to stop extinction-level heat will not be on the agenda. By the way, COP28 president-designate Sultan Ahmed Al-Jubar is the CEO of the UAE state-owned Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, also known as ADNOC. He is part of a new line of defense by fossil fuel producers. They say, we don't need to stop using fossil fuels. No, we can't do that. We just need to reduce emissions with carbon capture and storage or some other technology, which I'm sure will develop anytime soon. As you will hear later in this program, the biggest companies, from Chevron to Shell, have mostly dropped their pretense of winding down their climate-killing products. There is no Beyond Petroleum for BP. Greg Atkin, editor of the Inside Gas Bulletin, adds more facts to the stark statements by Antonio Guterres. From the trillions of dollars made by fossil fuel companies last year, every dollar they spend on finding even more fossil fuels, they will spend 4 cents on developing renewables. It's just window dressing. And that is the opposite of what should be happening to save a livable planet. The fossil addicts are heading out to buy lots more drugs, enough to kill us all. Also last week, a coalition of environmental groups announced worldwide protests for September 15 and 17. Even if you have never been to a protest, please mark those days on your calendar and consider what you can do in person or online to send a message to alleged climate negotiators. It is not okay to set the world on fire. We will not live with that.
Radio EcoShock.
To explain this worrying new sea ice science, we are joined by co-author Dr. Dirk Notz. Professor Notz leads the sea ice program at the University of Hamburg. He is deputy managing director for the University Institute of Oceanography and a longtime specialist in the field. From Hamburg, Dirk Notz, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, it's good to hear you.
Well, very seldom do scientists say it's too late. How did your team come to that conclusion about saving summer sea ice in the Arctic?
Well, it's been a kind of frustrating experience looking into Arctic sea ice over the past, say, 10, 15 years that I've been working in the field, because the ice has been dwindling more and more and more. And basically, since decades, scientists have predicted at some point it will be gone. And what we've now found in this new study is that realistically, in every emission scenario that we think could potentially unfold over the next years, the Arctic sea ice will disappear at least in some summers. So it's certainly not too late to save the ice from disappearing in all summers. For that, we need a lot of emissions. But it seems to be impossible, realistically, to avoid to have occasional ice-free summers at some point between 2030 and 2050.
In its 2021 report, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change predicted sea ice would, quote, be practically ice-free near mid-century under intermediate and high greenhouse gas emission scenarios. What does your new study find, and what in your approach makes a difference?
Yeah, so the quote from the IPCC report that you just quoted, that goes back to looking at the climate model simulations directly. So for every IPCC report, there's a dedicated set of climate model simulations being carried out. And those are then being analyzed in order to understand what will happen in the future in every aspect of our climate system. But I should say already, when writing the IPCC report, we were aware of the fact that these models were losing their ice too slowly, in particular relative to global warming. So in the real world, in the observational record that we have, we lose about 4 million square kilometers of Arctic sea ice per 1 degree of global warming. But in many of the models, we lose much less sea ice per degree of global warming. So we knew already then that the models were losing their ice too slowly. And so what we did in the IPCC report was to try and correct for these issues in an sort of ad hoc way by just selecting a few models and using linear extrapolations, etc., which made us also make this statement in this sort of more specialized chapter of the IPCC report to say that we are pretty certain that the ice will be lost in some summers before 2050 in every scenario. But what is now new in this study, that we've found a way to correct the bias in the model simulations by comparing their past simulation of the sea ice record to what we have observed. And by then analyzing how quickly the models lose their ice, how quickly it was lost in reality, we were able to then bias correct also the future simulations of the sea ice cover. And this then gives us much more confidence that this time period, 2030 to 2050, really is the most likely one for the first ice-free summer in the Arctic.
Why does it matter if the Arctic Ocean becomes open sea sooner, like in the 2030s instead of 2050 or even 2070, as they used to predict?
Well, I guess it does matter because it shows us how quickly climate change is unfolding. And it also means that almost every person who's alive on this planet today is quite likely to witness an ice-free Arctic throughout their lifetime. And I feel that one of the problems really in reacting to climate change is that many of the major impacts seem quite remote, either geographically or temporally in time. And so the fact that something will happen in the 2030s, I think, really increases the feeling of urgency also when it comes to taking action towards stopping global warming.
Dr. Knotts, will an ice-free summer in the Arctic Sea lead to more global warming itself? Is it a positive feedback effect?
It will lead to more warming, certainly in the Arctic, which is what we term Arctic amplification, the fact that the Arctic is warming more rapidly than other parts of the planet, because the sea ice is a huge sunlight mirror, one could say. And so in summer, when the sunlight is, when the sun is in the sky for 24 hours, much of that sunlight that hits the surface in the Arctic is being reflected back to space by the sea ice cover. And now this sunlight mirror is becoming smaller and smaller and smaller and might eventually disappear. And so more and more and more sunlight stays in the system and heats the Arctic. And that is one of the reasons why the Arctic is heating up more than other parts of the planet. But it's not really a very strong feedback in the sense that this, what scientists call the ice albedo feedback loop, isn't particularly strong when it comes to the loss of Arctic sea ice. So there have, say some 10, 15 years ago, there has been this worry that we might lose Arctic sea ice cover unstoppably simply because we have less ice, more absorption of sunlight, warmer water means less ice, more absorption of sunlight. But this vicious circle is broken every winter. And so it only works in summer when the sun is up in the sky. But in winter, there are feedbacks going the other way around. And this basically stabilizes the sea ice cover to a degree that the loss of sea ice is largely linear relative to both global temperature and to greenhouse gas emissions by us humans, and that there isn't any self-acceleration.
That's a bit of a relief to hear. Now, if it does rebuild every winter, but if there's a summer where it can't build on previous ice because that melted, wouldn't the ice be thinner?
Exactly. And so in the future, with a complete loss of summer sea ice, the ice will be thinner. But I should say that many of these changes in the Arctic have already been unfolding over the past, say, 20, 30 years. So if you look at a map of the age of the sea ice cover in the Arctic in the mid-1980s, you would find that back then about half of the sea ice was more than 4 years old. So it was circulating in the Arctic Ocean for a couple of years, getting thicker and thicker. The salt would drain out of the ice, and you would get this almost fresh ice near the surface that expeditions could then use to produce their meltwater, their drinking water. But if you look at a map of sea ice age today, you will find that almost all this ice that is like 4 or 3 years old is gone. So already now the sea ice cover in the Arctic is very much younger than it used to be. And this trend will simply continue over the coming years.
Even later this century, though, some scientists expect pockets of sea ice to hang on, say, around the Canadian archipelago. What is the technical definition of an ice-free Arctic?
Yes, so what the wording that we've been using for the IPCC report, and that I think is a good description, is that we call our findings practically sea ice free, and we use a threshold of less than 1 million square kilometer of sea ice, and that is about 10 to 15% of the initial sea ice cover, and this last ice, as you say, will be found at the northern edges of Greenland, some bays in northern Canada. But it's sort of the Arctic Ocean itself is practically ice-free. Say, if you want to go to the North Pole with a ship, you wouldn't find ice floes. If you look at the ecosystem side of things, much of the Arctic will be ice-free and not support any ecosystem that needs sea ice. And so, therefore, we think it's useful to have this definition of a practically ice-free Arctic Ocean once the sea ice cover drops below 1 million square kilometers.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, just during my single lifetime, what was always frozen has become an open ocean at times, stretching 1,500 miles or 2,400 kilometers from Canada all the way to Russia. Do you find that mind-boggling?
I absolutely do. And I think, for me, that might be one of the most important impacts of our finding, namely that we're basically communicating that we are losing an entire landscape. And somehow there seems to be something deep within us humans that connects us to this landscape. So I sometimes give talks in kindergartens or preschools or with kids like 4, 5, 6 years old. And when I show them pictures from the Arctic, from my expeditions there, they are absolutely amazed. They are like, are you really going to these places? Have you seen polar bears? And there seems to be something incredibly fascinating about these landscapes rooted deeply within us. And the fact that we are basically making this entire landscape disappear, at least in some summers initially, means that we are losing this kind of fascinating landscape. And somehow I expect this will do something with how we perceive this planet, that the Arctic in the future is just an open ocean like every other. And it really changes, in some sense, I think, our view of this world.
So when was the last time the Arctic was more or less ice-free? Has it been frozen during all the time of Homo sapiens, even during our evolution?
It was probably ice-covered for much of our evolution, if you take the last, say, 200,000 years, because the Arctic has been comparatively cold for the past 4 or 5 million years, also during which time the Greenland ice sheet was building up. And so certainly since humans have existed in, say, Europe, the US, Canada, the Arctic was ice-covered all year round.
Is it conceivable most of the Arctic Ocean could be ice-free year-round, and do we know what amount of warming it would take to do that?
That is much more uncertain compared to predicting when the ice might be gone in summer, because the climate models, even though they disagree for the summer timing, they disagree even more for the loss of the winter sea ice. But what they all agree on is that we do need substantially more warming than, say, 2 or 2.5 degrees, or 2 degrees as set by the Paris Protocol. But it is, of course, possible that given sufficient warming, the Arctic might eventually become ice-free all year round. In terms of timing, most climate models only see this happening at some point, say, early next century.
Dirk Knotts, does the lack of summer sea ice alter weather patterns or currents of wind or oceans further south?
I think the jury on that one is still open. There are a couple of studies that have suggested that this is the case, and if you take a climate model and you keep everything else constant and you just remove the ice cover, you do see a signal in weather patterns. But a number of other studies have found that in reality the signal is too small to be visible in all the noise of weather patterns and jet stream wiggles that we usually have anyways. And so there might be some impact, but there many studies have shown that this impact might not stand out from the noise. And so when looking at this in the last IPCC report, we basically said that we have low confidence in our understanding and in the certainty that we really will see a measurable impact of these changes on our weather.
And has seasonally disappearing sea ice contributed to the global trend of ocean warming? We see hotter oceans in the Atlantic and the North Pacific. Will the Arctic Ocean warm, and do those waters interact with that great conveyor belt that adds heat to other oceans?
Yes, the Arctic Ocean certainly is warming because, like physically, as long as you have ice in contact with seawater, the ice is sort of trying to keep the seawater at freezing temperature. But now with longer and longer ice-free periods in larger and larger parts of the ocean, the average temperature of the Arctic Ocean is certainly rising just now. And we also see more what we call marine heat waves. And so basically temperature patterns in the Arctic Ocean that stand out from the internal variability or natural variability of ocean temperatures. However, the connection between the Arctic Ocean and the rest of the world's ocean isn't particularly strong when it comes to its temperature. More important, however, is the freshwater export from the Arctic into the Fram Strait, into the region east of Greenland and around Greenland, because there a lot of so-called deep water is being formed. And so only in the polar regions does the seawater become so dense, because it's both cold and salty, that it can sink all the way to the seafloor and then from there spread over all the world's ocean near the bottom. And this sinking of the ocean water near Greenland is very sensitive to how much fresh water there is around. And with more melting of sea ice, with more inflow from large rivers into the Arctic Ocean is freshening. And thus, this might contribute to a bit of the weakening of the ocean circulation that we are expecting in the North Atlantic throughout the century.
But that's the ocean circulation that keeps Germany and England much warmer than they would be for the latitude where you are.
Indeed. So we're not expecting this circulation to break down altogether. We expect probably a weakening of about 30%. There is a small chance that it might collapse the circulation, because also their models have problems in reproducing the processes that we think are really important, which also means that you look at maps of global warming. The global warming is often weakest in the North Atlantic because you reduce the inflow of warm water from further south with the slowdown of this ocean circulation. So we still have warming everywhere. It's just somewhat weaker, potentially in the North Atlantic and then maybe in Ireland and Iceland.
Do we really know all the ramifications of early sea ice loss in the Arctic? Could this trigger a system elsewhere on the planet? Are there teleconnections with things like rainfall in the Amazon or wildfires in North America?
I would be surprised if we would find anything like that, because for the climate system, there isn't anything particularly special about even losing the last ice floe in the Arctic, because for the climate system, we have already lost half of the sea ice cover in the Arctic. And one could imagine that the impact of this first half is roughly equally large as losing the second half as well. There could, of course, be surprises, but because of the jet stream and other phenomena, the Arctic is a bit isolated from the rest of our planet, both in terms of its connection to the world's ocean, but also in the atmosphere, where we certainly do have connections, but I personally do not expect any major impacts from this loss of summer sea ice on sort of the major weather patterns that we have further south. There is, of course, this possibility, but we have relatively weak evidence in that direction.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Arctic sea ice may disappear in summer in the next 10 years. Alex talks with ice expert Dirk Knotts from the University of Hamburg.
Your team doesn't suggest we try to save the sea ice with geoengineering, like blasting sulfur into the stratosphere over the far north. Why not?
We haven't really looked into sort of ways of potentially saving the ice, and I'm certainly not an expert on geoengineering. And my take on geoengineering is that much of that, whether we do it or whether we don't do it, at the end of the day, will be a societal decision. But the problem that I know with many of the geoengineering methods suggested is that they usually have adverse side effects, negative side effects, and at least some other parts maybe of the planet. And so at the end, deciding as to how we potentially might change the climate or how we want to affect the climate will be politically extremely difficult to sort out. And so even if we were to stabilize the global mean temperature by putting solar mirrors into the space, it would be a different climate in many regions of the world, even though the average it would be the same. So in that sense, I think we are currently doing geoengineering in the sense of putting a lot of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and by that way changing the climate through technical methods. And I think the only technique that we can agree on that would make sense would be to reverse this geoengineering that we're currently carrying out by putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere by trying to remove them again and store them at somewhere underground, for example.
And the new study says the early arrival of a seasonally open Arctic sea means humanity needs to plan and to adapt to a new reality. What plans could we make? How could we adapt?
Well, I guess the primary impacts of an ice-free Arctic Ocean will be for the people who live in the Arctic, but many of them are already adjusting to the new reality of having much longer ice-free periods in summer, having winters where ice might not form where it used to form. For example, in Greenland, I've talked to some of the hunters there who told me that they are not using their dog sledges anymore because there's no safe sea ice to travel on anymore. So they just go fishing all winter round. And so in that sense, they are already adapting. But of course, given the current tensions that we have, the fact that suddenly in the Arctic, the states that border the Arctic, including Russia, including the U.S. with Alaska, including Canada, including the European countries, if there suddenly is completely open water in summer, it of course means that there is much easier connection also between these countries. And I guess also in that direction, there already is a lot of planning happening that we probably don't know about.
With three decades under our belts and more sophisticated sensors, there is a better chance to compare model results with the observed record. And that's really what you've done in this paper, isn't it? Do you see it as a change in climate science?
Yes, absolutely. Also, with some of the earlier studies that I've been involved in, where we found a very, very clear linear relationship between the Arctic sea ice cover and the CO2 emissions, which allowed us to calculate that for each metric ton of CO2 that a person emits, about 3 square meters of Arctic sea ice disappear. That number and that finding was primarily based on the observational record. And so the only information we took from the climate models for this study was the fact that this linearity also exists in every climate model and basically will be kept up until all the ice is gone. So we basically can extrapolate the observed record into the future to get some estimate of when the Arctic will be ice-free.
You have been researching sea ice for more than a decade, publishing many papers. What do you think is left to be done?
Well, I think from my perspective, the real big questions when it comes to sea ice research currently are emerging in the Southern Ocean. Because in the Southern Ocean, we have a situation that we there have a lot of sea ice in winter and very little in summer. And so in some sense, the Arctic is getting more like the Antarctic in the sense of having very, very little ice in summer and still a lot in winter. But the models are doing a terrible job in some sense to project what is happening there. So, for example, we had no real ice loss in the Antarctic, which we think is connected to the fact that in the Antarctic, the amount of sea ice area that we have, it's much closer linked to the wind patterns that we have compared to the Arctic. Because in the Arctic, the ice is landlocked, so it can't go anywhere no matter how the winds blow. And so in the Arctic, the amount of sea ice primarily depends on the freezing and melting in the central Arctic Ocean or in the Arctic Ocean itself. But in the Southern Ocean, the winds that blow from the continent, from the Antarctic continent that sits on the South Pole towards north, distributes the Arctic sea ice on the surface of the ocean. And so the amount of sea ice area that we have in the Southern Ocean is much more driven by changes in the wind patterns. And we believe that some of the fact that we have lost very little ice in the Southern Ocean so far has been related to the potential increase of these winds. But now over the past few years, we've seen a strong negative trend of Southern Ocean sea ice coverage. And it is currently unclear if that's sort of just a hiccup in the climate system and that we will go back to the sea ice that we've had before, or whether that's really is the beginning of a real trend in Southern Ocean sea ice. And the problem why we've not been able to simulate sea ice particularly well in the Southern Ocean is that many of the processes there depend on what the ocean does. And the Southern Ocean is characterized by its large amount of small-scale ocean eddies that we couldn't resolve in earlier generations of climate models. But now we are developing higher and higher resolved, spatially resolved climate models. And so it now starts to become possible to also get faithful simulations of the Southern Ocean.
From the Institute of Oceanography at Hamburg University, we've been speaking with sea ice specialist Professor Dirk Knotts. He is co-author of Breaking Science, published in the journal Nature Communications. The title is Observationally Constrained Projections of an Ice-Free Arctic, Even Under a Low Emissions Scenario. Find links to that open access paper in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Dirk Knotts, thank you for sharing your valuable time with our listeners.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
As you heard, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres just demanded oil companies stop investing in new supplies of climate-killing carbon. They need to wind down those operations and find a new business model in sustainable energy. But you might as well ask a fentanyl addict to switch to yoga. They have just gone out to get us more deadly drugs. Fossil fuel industries claim greater demand forces investing all their recent big profits into even more production. We just had two interviews reporting on the splurge of fossil fuel investments by the biggest banks and private investment firms. April Merlot from Rainforest Action Network named the big banks lending billions for new drilling, mining, and fracking. Then Katrin Ganswind from the German group Urgewald revealed the investment companies putting trillions more to expand fossil fuel production. It's the exact opposite of what we need to do. You can find those interviews free at ecoshock.org. Take the case of so-called natural gas. It is just methane. And in America, 80% of it comes from fracking. Of course, blowing up the underground, injecting super toxic and radioactive chemicals to get those bubbles of gas broken up. Well, nothing could be more natural than that, right? That is where we need Greg Aitken. As Europe scrambles for gas, Greg is editor of the weekly Inside Gas Bulletin for the NGO Global Energy Monitor. This free bulletin is like an industry insider about projects that every community and activist should know about. This interview was tough technically. The phone line to the Czech Republic was poor and disconnected Greg and I at least four times. We made it happen, and I may have to interrupt now and then if a clarification is needed. Listen carefully, though. You will hear how the gas industry is ramping up methane production to save the world from climate change, apparently. Even former green voices like Germany now have methane madness. From Brno in the Czech Republic, Greg Aitken, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi there.
Hi. So tell us about the scramble for natural gas in Europe after the sudden decline of Russian supply.
Yeah, well, obviously, last year, after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, there was a big emergency situation where EU member states that had long been very dependent on Russian gas imports. Well, first of all, there were several countries that had their supplies cut off by Russia. Well, Germany was facing the problem because Russia was starting to reduce flows through the Nord Stream 1 gas pipeline, which has been operating for quite some time. So really, there was just a big rush for Europe to diversify away from Russian imports. And this was also a move that was taken forward by the European Commission, which introduced a program called the Repower EU plan, which essentially was looking to set targets for diversifying from Russian gas and also to be looking at energy-saving measures, basically reducing Europe's use of or consumption of gas out to 2030, which was tying in with longer plans in the making from Europe to get off gas. But the short-term effect was to really go for this huge scramble for gas, and European buyers really switched their thoughts to LNG. Now, Europe has had, over the last 15 or so years, quite a number of LNG import terminals, which hadn't, until recently, really been working at full capacity. Because of the rush for new LNG from the likes of the US, also from Africa, from the Middle East, these existing terminals started to be operating at much closer to full capacity. And alongside that, there was a lot of rapid planning of developing new terminals. And a whole raft of new projects were proposed. Quite a few were up and running within about 6 months of the war. Some new floating import terminals in the Netherlands, and others have been planned and have been set in motion. And Germany has been the main focus for the new import terminal build-out. It has currently made operational three new terminals in about the space of a year, and has six or seven which are currently being planned or are under construction. So it's basically just been a huge effort to scour the globe looking for new gas supplies, which has been difficult because generally we're in a tight global gas supply period at the moment. And so the result was last summer to see skyrocketing gas prices, which also had major impacts on other countries, particularly developing world countries, where the huge prices caused major problems for gas supply to these countries, Pakistan, Bangladesh, other countries in Southeast Asia, which over the course of last year saw quite lengthy power blackouts, which were damaging for the economy, for society, and so forth. So there have been many kind of knock-on effects from Europe's mad dash for gas.
Yeah, you know, Russia would have been sending a lot of gas to Europe and other trading partners, and now it can't. What is it doing with the gas?
Well, it's trying its best to forge new deals with the likes of China, with a couple of major pipeline deals which appear to be moving forward quite slowly. Russia is also currently making efforts to talk to other countries in Southeast Asia for cementing new longer-term deals. At the same time, an interesting aspect in the whole Russian situation is not all pipeline gas from Russia has to the EU has been cut off. Some is still coming through a couple of pipelines and also, interestingly, through a transit route in Ukraine. But one of the more embarrassing things, I think, for the European Union has been that supplies of Russian LNG have been coming through still to European ports. And there hasn't been, unlike with oil and other Russian products, there hasn't been a concerted effort to sanction Russian LNG flows, for example. So as far as I know, there is a lot of Russian gas which is not being exported at all and is looking to be used, I think, for new projects in Russia. But it's been trying to diversify its exports, but it's fairly slow progress at the moment. But it's certainly, I think, aware that the writing is on the wall for Europe, for exporting to Europe longer term.
Well, natural gas, as it's called, is really methane, mostly methane. In your view, Greg, is the global natural gas industry expanding production, or is it just rearranging existing markets?
That's a very wide question. Just this week, for example, Shell is holding a kind of an investor day in New York where it is about to tell the investment community that it regards gas as more than just the transition fuel, which we've heard about in for the last 10 years, but Shell is reportedly set to commit to increasing its investments in upstream exploration and production. Similar noises have been made from the likes of Chevron in recent weeks. And so the oil and gas majors are certainly winding back from the transition policies which have been in place for the last few years. And I think bowing to the investor pressure that they've felt for this. At the same time, as we come up to another climate summit in United Arab Emirates in November, I think there's alarm being raised at the fact that conference is obviously being led by a major petrol state with also huge gas interests. And I think climate groups are alarmed at basically the fact that getting phase-out commitments from countries so far hasn't materialized. It has materialized for coal, but there's nothing on paper or has been agreed to actually to get to a phase-out agreement for oil and gas. So it's difficult to say whether gas production is being expanded, but certainly there doesn't appear to be a quieting of new announcements for new exploration and production investments, even though the International Energy Agency 2 years ago, under its net zero emission scenario, was saying there is no more room as of 2022 for new production. So it's not looking great, I would have to say.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Greg Aitken, from the Global Energy Monitor. Greg specializes in tracking world gas production. Do you know what percentage of gas is fracked compared to the old-style wells? I was just wondering.
I have to say that's difficult to know, really. I'm aware that, obviously, fracking is predominantly a major technique used in North America, USA and Canada. According to the U.S. Energy Administration statistics for 2022, 80% of U.S. gas production came from shale formations. So, that suggests that fracking was used for around about 80% in the US. Globally, I wouldn't be able to put a figure on it.
Well, I've heard that fracking is spreading to other parts of the world. Australia, Poland's talked about whether they have frackable reserves. It could spread and become a worldwide phenomenon.
Well, over the last 10 years or so, there's been a lot of speculation about fracking development globally. Australia, as you say, is one country where there have been some new developments. Argentina as well, with Vaca Muerta, major shale formation in that country where some fracking is taking place, and there are proposals for more. Generally, though, in many places that there have been moratoria put in place by national governments banning fracking. In Europe, there was a lot of fracking hype about 10 years ago, but fundamentally, the issue in Europe is much more densely populated continents and really limited water supplies, limited land available to carry out a practice which is widely regarded as being highly destructive and resource intense.
As we know, Poland built an industrial economy on coal, and now it seems everyone from the European Union to the United States will help Poland finance gas to just stop those coal emissions. Talk to us about gas politics and the outlook in Poland.
One of the interesting things about Poland is that because in the European Union context, because Poland has been really so much the bad boy in terms of its coal industry, obviously it's a decade-long industry which has, you know, dominated Polish society for a long time. But Poland has really been dragged, kicking and screaming, by the European Commission to make some concessions that the coal industry will have to decline. And so as a result of that, when it comes to Polish gas ambitions, what I've heard from colleagues in Brussels is that the European Commission is rather relieved if Poland budges at all from coal. The plans for gas expansion, despite the EU's commitments to reduce gas consumption by 2030 and thereafter, Polish gas ambitions are somehow being tolerated. They have one LNG import terminal operational. They have plans for a couple more terminals. And I think also as well, in a recent deal last week, which was agreed by the US, a US government bank, it agreed to guarantee a $500 million financial deal, which allows one of Poland's biggest energy companies to import US LNG. So there are certainly political elements to the likes of Poland being permitted to get off coal via gas. But at the same time, Poland has a wealth of renewables potential, especially offshore in the Baltic Sea. The question really has to be asked of all the EU member states which have signed up to EU greenhouse gas emission reduction targets is, how long do you really want to lock in your economies to gas when you're legally obliged to be reducing your emissions?
We still hear gas promoted as a greenish bridge to a low-carbon future. Do you personally think there's enough room in the atmosphere for another few decades of burning gas?
I think gas will have to feature, and it can't be knocked out by 2030 or 2040. And I think most low-carbon scenarios see a role for gas out to 2050 and quite possibly beyond. It's just a worry and a concern that investments that are being lined up now, which are multi-decades in terms of how long they will potentially run for, that including gas, which obviously involves the combustion of methane, which is, and also much leaking, methane leakage, that the prospects are, unless more and more of these investments are restricted, that we are going to below the carbon budget because of gas.
Has any country or institution gone so far to declare methane gas is a clean, green energy?
Yeah, well, in various ways, this is still happening in the last month or so. In Mexico, gas-fired power was reclassified by the government as clean, for instance. In the last 6 months, in several U.S. states, there have been legislative moves to call gas clean and sustainable. One of the most kind of fought-over issues in Europe in the last couple of years regarded the European Union's so-called taxonomy for financially sustainable investments. And the EU, despite much pressure and despite much protest from climate groups and scientists as well, it decided to label gas as a sustainable source of energy. It's still happening.
And tell us about the UK's advertising watchdog banning big energy greenwashing that was being pumped out on the media.
Yes, well, this is part of a growing concern internationally about greenwashing claims for products of all kinds, but also marketing campaigns that are coming from major oil and gas firms. And the UK watchdog, which I think is currently drawing up new standards for what is permissible for companies to accurately show what they're doing, it took action in the last couple of weeks against Shell and against a couple of other foreign companies, which, as one sees very often, are very much heavily promoting the clean side of their businesses with electric charging points for vehicles and other nice things, which make up a minuscule percentage of these companies' business models. And the UK watchdog was basically making the point that this is all very well and good, but if you don't put this in the context of what your majority business is doing in terms of not reducing emissions, not planning to curb your production of oil and gas, then essentially you're misleading customers. So the prescription was to ban certain campaigns, particularly one from Shell.
We've been speaking with Greg Aitken, editor of Inside Gas Bulletin. Find it at www.globalenergymonitor.org. You can also find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Greg, thank you for helping us out.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Next week, we talk with Dr. Peter Carter, the medical doctor who now tries to heal the world's climate. Peter tells it like it is, and then backs all that up with climate science. I also hope to speak with Australian military analyst Elizabeth Bolton. She is telling militaries, including the U.S. Marine Corps, around the world to prepare for social chaos as climate change goes off the rails. My thanks to all the volunteers and dedicated people making nonprofit radio happen and the 106 stations that play this show. Be sure to join us again next week. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.